With America's 250th anniversary coming, fly the stars and stripes with pride. WGN Flag Company is celebrating this milestone with commemorative 250th anniversary American flags, all made with premium craftsmanship here in the USA. Perfect for homes, businesses, and community events. Honor our nation's past and inspire the next generation with a premium flag that stands for freedom, unity, and American spirit. Order yours today at WGNflag.com. WGNflag.com. WGN Flag Company, over 110 years proudly serving Chicagoland and the world, waving American tradition forward.
The 4th of July comes once a year. The semi-quincentennial comes but once every 250. This is that year.
Hi, this is John Williams, and thank you for finding our latest installment in WGN Radio's celebration of the USA's birthday. 250 years now, sponsored by WGNflag.com. Order your 250th anniversary American flag today. Here is the latest episode. And so we are up now to Amendment number 6 in our podcast series, The 10 American Commandments. And for this episode, I've reached out to the author of The Year of Living Constitutionally. A.J. Jacobs is an author I've talked to many times. Listeners to my show on WGN Radio have heard me talk to him about The Know-It-All, his breakthrough book where he read the Encyclopedia Britannica A to Z, carried it around with him for a year, and was an unending and annoying font of information. And then The Year of Living Biblically. You wrote about puzzling during the pandemic, but then you took a year to live constitutionally. So I'm going to let you first talk to us just a little bit about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights that year, but then we'll dive into the Sixth Amendment. A.J. Jacobs, welcome to our podcast series. How are you?
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. And good morrow, of course, as good. They might say, as yes. Our founders might say.
Yeah, you're not wearing your tricorn hat right
now.
I brought it. Just for my purposes, go ahead. You spend a year actually wearing that old-timey tricorn hat. If you can imagine what Paul Revere had on his head, that funny-looking hat, there you are with that.
It's hard to do with the headphones for the podcast.
Yeah. But well, you can take it off if you must.
Okay.
What was the point of a year living constitutionally?
Well, it was kind of a sequel to the book that you mentioned earlier, The Year of Living Biblically. And for that, I wanted to find out, what did the Bible mean? What was the original meaning of the Bible? And of course, it's a very difficult to figure out, but I enjoyed trying. And I thought that the Constitution had many of the same questions. What did the founders mean when they wrote these words? And of course, that's endlessly debated. And the answers to those questions have an enormous impact on our lives, on the way we live, the way we worship, the way we can, what we can print. So I said, I'm going to get inside the minds of our founding fathers, and I'm going to wear the tricorn hat and eat the mutton, and I'm going to write with a quill pen, and I'm going to carry a musket, and I'm going to quarter soldiers. I know you talked about that. I thought this might be a way to get insight into what our founders were thinking when they wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
What were some takeaways for you?
Well, many takeaways. One was that the Constitution is a wonderful document. It is one of the foundations of democracy, but life has changed since then. So I feel we have to change a little with it. And I think the founders themselves wanted it to be a bit of an elastic document. They were very forward thinking in their own way, and they would not have wanted us to stick with exactly what they wrote.
A lot of the things that they wrote about were very progressive by their standards and even by today's standards. But you're right. We're trying to read into a 250, or in this case, 235-year-old document, issues that they could not have anticipated.
No. I mean, I actually, as part of this, this was a couple of years ago, but I did ask ChatGPT to take on the persona of James Madison. And I asked that version of James Madison, does the Second Amendment apply to automatic weapons? And That James Madison said no. I don't know what the real James Madison would say, but that was just an example. It's very hard to know what they would think of today's issues, which is why the original meaning of the Constitution is a very important part of interpreting the Constitution, but not the only part. Well, you also have to take into account what's happening today.
We're going to get to the Sixth Amendment, but I'm glad you brought up the Second, because I reread again some of the things you said about it in your book. And the Second Amendment is the most vexing of the amendments. I think it's one of the things that Americans both struggle with to understand what they meant, but then also feel like, I don't care what they meant, here's how I feel today. So maybe it does apply, maybe it doesn't apply. But just talk to me for a second about the Second Amendment. What's your thought about it and its application today?
Well, it is a fascinating amendment. And when they wrote the Constitution, the main gun of choice was the musket. It wasn't the only gun, but it was the main one they were talking about. And the musket, I did carry a musket around New York City as part of my Second Amendment right.
Think about that. This guy walking around with a tricorn hat on, carrying a musket, a great big old honking rifle from the 18th century around New York City. Keep going.
That is right. And it did come in handy in a couple of times. I walked into a coffee shop at the same time as another guy, and he said, "You go first. I'm not going to argue with the guy."
Fair enough.
But I also went and I shot it at a range, and it was literally 14 steps to shoot the musket. You have to take out the ramrod. You have to pour the gunpowder in. 14 steps. It's like building an IKEA desk. It takes a long time. So it is a fundamentally different type of weapon. You could not do a mass shooting along the lines of what some of these horrible mass shootings are with a musket, because it takes so long. So the big question is, when interpreting the Second Amendment, do you apply that word gun, that arms, to what we have now? Now, the conservatives would say yes. The gun rights activists would say yes. Of the gun, the ones who wanted to limit guns would say no. And their argument would be, it's such a different machine that applying the same word to it almost doesn't make sense. Imagine if there was a law in 1776 that said, it's okay to have wheeled vehicles come down this little country lane. Back then, that was like a wheelbarrow. Now, a wheeled vehicle is, an 18-wheel truck. So it's a very different thing. So do you reassess knowing that the technology has changed so much?
Well, it's not like Supreme Court justices have not had a chance to weigh in on that. You'd note that Justice Scalia said that they are still bearable arms. These are arms that I can carry. And you also said that there is, it's often noted that it's in order to maintain a well-regulated militia, the Second Amendment also says the right of the people, and that would seem to defer to an individual's right to carry a bearable arm. So somehow the advocates find language in that amendment to what they say supports their cause. And they say, I do have a right to personal self-defense. You point to a number of arguments that one side could offer to suggest that gun laws in America are sane right now and are what the founding fathers intended. I don't know that you believe that. I don't, but
I don't either. I believe that they would have wanted us to evolve as the technology evolves. And I think they built in this mechanism in the Constitution to change it, which is amendments. What I think they underestimated was how hard it would be to get to change the Constitution.
Yeah.
It is so hard. The last one we had was 30 years ago, and that I just don't see another one coming. So if they had made it more amendable, which I think if they were alive today, they would have said, "Oops, We should have made it a little easier. Then you could tweak something like the Second Amendment. You could change it. And I think Madison, who designed all of these, was very interested. He did not want the amendments at the end. He wanted just change the document like a Google Doc. And so that way it was much less about these sacred words.
Oh, yes. It's a living document then. It's a Google Doc before there was Google.
Exactly.
I just want to read a page. And by the way, the expression flash in the pan, you remind us, is what happens when there's a flash in the pan of a musket, but not sufficient to ignite the rest of the gunpowder to fire the ball out the gun. And that's what happened to you. You pulled the trigger. There was a flash in the pan, but your gun didn't fire.
I did experience. Yes.
Eventually.
Eventually I did. Yes.
But you wrote, if you go to the NRA website, you can read such arguments as mass murderers have repeatedly been deterred or stopped by citizens carrying lawfully concealed firearms, and that over the past three decades, up until 2019, violent crime rates have dropped by more than half. The number of privately owned firearms in the United States doubled in that same period. So they try and make a correlation out of that. I just say all of that to give a little air to the people who maybe want to interpret the Second Amendment differently than I do, and there are some arguments in their favor. And certainly they have a court that is on their side right now.
Right. And I love that you're doing that, because I feel that's the only way we're going to move forward, is if we understand the other side's arguments instead of dismissing them completely as inane, even though that's very tempting.
Okay, so then on to the Sixth Amendment. Speaking of being fair to both sides, here's what the Sixth Amendment says, and one I'll ask you to comment on, and tell us if in some way you lived this tenet. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused, think about this now, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district where the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and the cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have assistance of counsel for his defense. Defense spelled with a C. Okay, so what are they telling us there?
Well, this is all about getting a speedy trial, a public trial, a fair trial, being tried by your peers instead of in secret by a bunch of people appointed by the king. So it is actually, it doesn't get a lot of play. It's not like the First or Second Amendment. It's not doesn't get a lot of glory, but it is very important and symbolic of what the founders were trying to do, which was protect us from tyranny. This is very key. They saw the jury as really important as elections in protecting us from tyranny, because we were rebelling against a system that had all these secret trials that were totally unfair, and judges that answered to no one except the king. So this was a way to distribute power to the people. And it was, or at least the white male people. And it was really important in preventing concentration of power and tyranny, which is one of the main obsessions of our founding fathers. So I actually am a big fan.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan.
Well, I think it is. You're right. It doesn't get the attention the First and Second Amendments do, but it's such a backstop to the way we expect to live in this country. You know, I have a right to a fair trial. I get to confront my accuser. If I can't afford counsel, one will be appointed to me, and hopefully that'll be a reasonable attorney. We expect those things, but how fortunate for us that 250 and 235 years ago, they foresaw those things as necessary.
Right. I mean, personally, I see jury duty as a chore, and I get annoyed every time I get that slip. But I really shouldn't. I really should be quite grateful that they built in, as you say, this backstop. And it's really important because as I say, the distribution of power. You don't want power concentrated in one judge. They didn't trust a single judge. They didn't want it concentrated in one president. And I'm happy to talk about that. How shocked, how they would be like flipping their wigs, and they did wear wigs, at how much power our president has now and how it's increased over the centuries. I mean, Trump is certainly got more power than anyone in history, but even Biden and Obama had way more power than the founders wanted. And I do think that relates to the Sixth Amendment, because it was all about stopping one person from having power.
I think about Teddy Roosevelt that way, too. I mean, he said, well, if the Constitution says I can't do it, then I guess I can. And that's sort of woven into the Ninth Amendment as well, one that we've talked about previously on this podcast. But I think when you look at Donald Trump, you can see so many abuses or stretching these amendments so thinly that it looks like not what they intended at all. It does look like an abuse. That's the fairest way to put that.
And I will say, one of my favorite facts I learned during this experiment was how controversial the idea of a single president was. When it was brought up at the Constitutional Convention that we should have a single president, several of the delegates said, "Are you jesting?" I don't know if they said that, but they were appalled because they said, "We just fought a bloody war to get rid of a monarch. And you're trying to invest a single person with this power? No, we should have a council of presidents. We should have 12. Ben Franklin said 12 presidents. Others said 3 or 5. Because you don't want, one of them said, if you make it a single president, that is the fetus of monarchy. So that's a little bit of a weird phrase, but what he was saying was that it'll just grow and grow and grow and eventually come out of the womb, and we'll have another monarch. We'll have another king, and we don't want that. So I think they would just be outraged if they saw what was happening now.
And where the president sometimes has the power to appoint Supreme Court justices, or the president's party can appoint and approve federal judges, you can see how the influence is great and that those two arms are not as independent of each other as we would hope.
No. And also that Congress was supposed to be the most powerful branch of government. I mean, that is Article Number 1, and it is more than twice as long as the other articles. So it was sort of the Congress was the first among equals, and then the president and Supreme Court were there to support him. But that has not been the case. That Congress has sort of been strangled by various reasons that we can go into. But again, the founders, they got a lot wrong. If they were racist, for one thing. But the idea of the balance of powers and separation of powers and keeping us from tyranny, on that, I say, hallelujah. They got that right. They were 100% right on that.
I often, you know, as I've just been spending days looking at and thinking about these things, I have described them as progressive. But in fact, much of this goes back to English common law. Some of it is 13th century stuff. And then certainly stuff that they were living by, at least in principle, in England. They were not affording those rights to the colonists, but some of this stuff was not completely out of the norm or out of the box, right? That these were ideas that people in other countries, say Great Britain, felt that these were rights that they should have, right? This isn't totally,
yeah.
We weren't reinventing the wheel here, were we?
Right. Well, we were redesigning it, but you're right, the wheel existed, and it is. It's a great point that we often overlook, that Parliament was moving in a democratic direction. They still had the king, but early on in his career, King George III, he deferred to Parliament. Once he got in a war with us, he became a little more dictatorial. But in the beginning, he was smart. I'm here to serve Parliament. So, which is fascinating that. And I loved listening to talk about other points of view. I listened to these two British historians do a several-hour podcast on the War of Independence, and their point of view was, we're a bunch of whiny, entitled Americans. If we had just stayed with Britain, it would have gone towards democracy, and we had to be these little rebels and upstarts and complaining about a tax, even though the tax was lower than what it was in Great Britain. Now, I'm not endorsing their point of view. I'm just pointing out that that is one interpretation.
In your book, The Year of Living Constitutionally, where you tried to live by the strictures of that era, how did you enact or encounter then the Sixth Amendment? Did you stage a trial, or did you commit a crime? How did you live constitutionally via the Sixth Amendment?
Yeah, I did not commit. I am actually quite glad I didn't commit a crime, because back then, what was considered cruel and unusual punishment was very different. For instance, the pillory, where you put your hands in and your head in, and people throw mud and other gross things at you, that was considered fine. That was, people were still doing that right into the 1780s, 1800s.
Really?
So I'm very glad that I didn't have to get pilloried. I did buy one on Etsy just to see what it was like, because they do offer them for, I guess, adult entertainment purposes. But I didn't have to go. One way that I tried to enact this, and it was not... It was a little more metaphorical, but it was the idea of trying to spread power around. So I feel that as a parent, I have three sons. Parents are very much tyrants. Like, we have absolute power. So I thought, what if I try to imitate what the founders, how they spread power around. So I decided my wife and I would be the Supreme Court. If my kids got in a fight, they would first have to go to the lower courts, which were their cousins who were closer to their age, and plead their case. Oh, he's making too much noise playing video games, I can't sleep. The cousins would weigh in. If that didn't solve it, they would go to their aunts and uncles. That's the higher court. And if that didn't solve it, they could appeal to the Supreme Court, my wife and I. So that was one way I tried to experiment with a different judicial system.
You could, that may be your next book, parenting via, I don't know what, not necessarily the Constitution, but there's a parenting book, I think, in you there, AJ.
Well, I'll tell you, that was fascinating. I talked to one constitutional scholar who specializes in family constitutions. There are thousands of families that actually write constitutions.
Here's how we're going to live as a family.
Yeah, exactly. Here's our mission statement. Here's our preamble. And then here are the laws. And there are some hilarious ones, like, you know, especially when it comes to dogs and fathers, there are a lot of stipulations. Like, the father will not be walking the dog. The father will not be cleaning up after the dog. So it's an interesting idea.
Well, we had a rule like that in my house when we got our first dog. I said, Grant, you will walk the dog. And he said, okay. And after a week, he didn't want to walk the dog. And I said, you said you would walk the dog. And he said, I did. And I realized,
he's a good lawyer.
This is how very constitutional of us, but the document wasn't specific enough. It didn't anticipate the abuse of the language. And I want to bring it back to a serious point. And it seems like anytime anybody gets an unfavorable ruling, they appeal it. They appeal it. The idea that we would have a speedy trial, or that there would be finality to these trials, does not seem to be very real, does it? I mean, and then the Supreme Court takes it, and then maybe they kick it back. It just seems like there's this labyrinth that's endless of opportunities in our court system, and I think that fails us in some ways.
That's a great point. And I also think what's interesting is, in many cases, the Constitution is vague. So it'll say that, you know, you have a right to due process. What does due process mean? It doesn't spell it out. The U.S. Constitution is the shortest constitution. I think there's actually Monaco might be slightly shorter, but most countries' constitutions are much longer and much more detailed and spell things out like the walking of the dog. It would spell out you have to walk it every day for this many minutes. And there are pros and cons to spelling out things in the Constitution. But one problem with having it be so vague is that people can, as you say, manipulate it. And the Supreme Court has way too much power, way too much latitude in changing up what the words mean. I think that power should reside in Congress and the lawmakers, not in these unelected judges.
Yeah. At the end of your book, you have some final takeaways, and one of them is to not beat up too much on the Constitution. In general, I think you are, who wouldn't be, but a proponent of what we have here, right? Both as the Constitution itself and the first 10 amendments, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the 10 amendments are so important to me because they are all about protecting us from tyranny, which I feel that we are slipping in that direction. I don't think it's an on-off switch. I don't think we've totally turned off the lights on it, but we're slipping in that direction, and we need to pay more attention to the amendments and the preamble. I love the preamble. Those are my favorite sentences because it lays out what this country means and what it's for, and the fact that they mention the general good, the good of society. And that is something that I think we've forgotten in our quest to be all about me, me, me. What can I take from this system? No, you have to look at what's good for all citizens.
I'm coursing through your book here to see if I can find the exact words of the preamble. Do you have those handy?
Oh, I did memorize them, and then I promptly forgot them. But yeah, we the people,
in order to form a more perfect union. No, hold on a second here. Do you have it in your book, AJ?
I can't remember. At one point I did.
I'm going to insert them here.
I have it. I just called it up if you want.
All right, go ahead and read it.
You can. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Just a wonderful 52 words that really sums up what America can and should be.
And one last thing then about all of that. Where did we lose our way, or are we losing our way? You said it's not an off switch, but
right.
if those principles are more challenged now than ever, why? What's happening?
Wow, big question. I would say a couple of things. One is that we are putting too much, we have a cult of personality where we instead of embracing the idea of America, which is about equal justice, the general welfare, we focus on these heroes who are flawed, to say the least. So let's go back to thinking about Americans instead of just focusing on this hero worship. Second point, I think it's important that when the founders wrote the Bill of Rights, I believe if they saw what America has become now, they would have included a Bill of Responsibilities. Because back then, that was implied. Everyone assumed that part of being an American was chipping in, was being in your militia, or if there's a fire, you go out and you pass the bucket. It was a lot about community, and I feel we've lost that. So I feel that we should have a Bill of Responsibilities in addition to a Bill of Rights to remember to take care of our neighbors.
The Year of Living Constitutionally is one man's humble quest to follow the Constitution's original meaning. And it's written by A.J. Jacobs, came out a couple of years ago. He wrote The Year of Living Biblically, among other things. If you only read one of his books, well, I like him like I like my kids, but The Know-It-All was where I first met you. And it's always been a pleasure to read you and talk to you, A.J. It's really nice that you could join us for our podcast today.
Well, you are a great American. Thank you for following the First Amendment and putting out great content. I don't think the founders called it content, but great ideas. So thank you for that.